Welcome to MiniMed Pods. Today we'll be talking about acute kidney injury, which is also known as acute renal failure. In this episode, we will be referring to acute kidney injury as AKI to avoid lots and lots of tongue ties in this episode. Simran, our student kidney expert, is here to talk about the condition, so let's take it away. How would you define an AKI?
So an AKI is basically defined by a sudden decrease in the function of the kidneys, and this decrease can be attributed to anything that causes direct or indirect damage to the kidney's structure or its function. Now, in terms of like situations where we would actually suspect it, usually it's a combination of signs, symptoms, investigations, and all of that put together that kind of reaches a diagnosis. But overall, the definition is that. And one thing to note is that usually for an AKI to happen, it involves a decline function in both of the kidneys. Because if there's a decline in function in one kidney, the other kidney can actually compensate for this. So AKI usually happens when there is damage to both kidneys and the kidneys cannot compensate.
You're telling me that if one kidney decides to decrease in function, die off, I'm not sure what happens to it, but basically become injured, the other kidney can actually replace its function.
Yeah, most of the time.
Or produce enough function or do its job well enough to make it look like our tests and the person itself is functioning completely 100%.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, that's probably why you can actually donate a kidney successfully. So what about the presentation? What are we looking for in a patient who has come in with suspected AKI?
Yeah, so presentation, I'll divide it into symptoms and signs. So let's first talk about the symptoms. So these kinds of patients, they may or may not be symptomatic. But if there are symptoms of an acute kidney injury, the most common symptom would be like reduced urine output or no urine output with like associated fatigue and just low energy. Other symptoms, if they are present, are also usually associated with a buildup of urea in the bloodstream. And these are called uremic symptoms. So one of the things that happens with AKI is there's actually buildup of toxins. And one of the major toxins is urea. So when there's enough buildup of urea in the bloodstream, there can be symptoms associated with it. The very non-specific ones would be like nausea, vomiting, loss of appetite, feeling really, really tired, having a headache. But then there's other sort of symptoms associated with certain signs, like encephalopathy. So they might be confused, they might be disoriented. High urea is also associated with pericarditis. So they might also have some chest pain or shortness of breath. Other sort of signs or symptoms of high urea would be peripheral neuropathy, so numbness, reduced sensation in like the legs, and they might also have muscle cramps. So the most common symptoms would be like the non-specific ones, and maybe some confusion and disorientation.
Because it's so non-specific, do you find that AKIs are usually caught coincidentally?
I think one, it could be. I think it's if you don't look for it, you may not find it. So if you're not doing investigations, because the diagnosis is very much dependent on two specific investigations that you would do, which we'll talk about later. But I think that it may be missed out or it may be delayed. There might be a delay to diagnosis. I think it also depends on how quickly a person is deteriorating and what's the actual cause of AKI, because there's so many causes. If there's like a toxic cause or some sort of infection, that causes a sudden decline and a very serious decline, then it may be picked up. But usually the presentation itself is also very specific to the cause. So whether or not it's picked up incidentally, it may just be like you might not even consider it as a diagnosis, but then when you do investigation, you'd be like, oh, the kidney function is actually declining. Maybe they do have an AKI. So in that situation, the diagnosis may just be an incidental diagnosis and may not be one of your differentials when a person is presenting. So in terms of the actual signs, like that you would see on examination, you want to do like, one would be like a proper kidney examination, which we actually did a podcast on. So you guys can actually listen to that as well to know what specific things you look for. But I'll just kind of pick out the things that you can see, like the positive signs you can see on examination. One thing is fluid assessment. So because these... most people who have an acute kidney injury do not produce enough urine. They actually retain a lot of fluid in their body. So you can actually see signs of fluid overload. And in that situation, you can listen to the heart, you can listen to the chest, because there might be fluid around the heart. So pericarditis, there might be fluid in the lungs. Fluid can actually accumulate in the lower limbs. So you want to see if there's any signs of pitting edema. And also the JVP may be raised. You also want to look at the mucous membranes, look at the skin trigger, look for capillary refill in situations where the person may look like they're fluid underloaded, so they're dehydrated. You also want to check blood pressure and vitals to make sure whether they're hemodynamically stable. And blood pressure is very much dependent on the kidney function. So if the kidneys are not functioning well, and there's fluid retention, and the blood pressure may also be high. And there's signs of high urea in the blood. So these are your uremic signs. So that would be your encephalopathy, uremic fetor, uremic bleeding, uremic frost, which is basically the precipitation of urea that kind of causes a sort of white frosting over the skin. Asterixis, which is a flapping tremor, and signs of pericarditis. So that would be like a pericardial friction rub. And if it actually progresses to be very severe, there might be signs of cardiac tamponade, which could be like muffled heart sounds, low blood pressure, and stuff like that. And you always want to record the weight, have a fluid balance chart, and check medication chart to see whether any medications might also be causing or contributing to the AKI.
Thank you. That's a really nice way to form an examination for people in general who present with AKIs. Now, previously you were talking about symptoms being sort of associated with the causes, and you said there were many, many causes. So could we talk about some of the causes of AKI?
So this is like super, super high yield. It's like the bread and butter of AKI. And I think you really, really need to know what the causes of AKI are to understand it. I know I myself had a really difficult time understanding it. I'm not sure about you, Xiao, but there is a basic way of classifying it, which everyone uses, and it's the pre-renal, renal, post-renal. Pre-renal will be like is the most common cause of AKI. And pre-renal causes of AKI include anything that reduces blood volume, so hypovolemia. So that could be things like congestive cardiac failure, liver failure, any sort of blood loss. So if there's any gastrointestinal bleed or intracranial bleed, any trauma, any burns. Fluid loss could also lead to hypovolemia. So if there's significant vomiting, diarrhea, or sweating, infection and sepsis can also lead to hypovolemia. And also poor intake of oral fluids and medications can also lead to hypovolemia. Other things that are considered pre-renal is renal artery stenosis. And that causes pre-renal AKI because it doesn't have to do with the volume, but it actually has to do with how much blood is actually getting to the kidneys for filtration. So with renal artery stenosis, because the arteries are so narrow, there's not enough blood getting to the kidneys. And so that's affecting the actual filtration of the kidneys. So there's less fluid excretion by the kidneys. And as I mentioned, like medications like diuretics can cause pre-renal AKI. Other medications include like NSAIDs or ACE inhibitors, which again can affect the flow of blood or just affect the function of the kidneys, that it's actually affecting the filtration. Now, in terms of, so that's your pre-renal. That's a lot of information. So Xiao, do you want to quickly summarize what I just told you?
For sure. So pre-renal causes seems like it's very much to do with fluid flow or blood flow to the kidneys. So things that affect the fluid in your body, so hypovolemia and all the multiple and many, many causes of hypovolemia. And then you have the more specific ones like medications that affect blood flow to the kidney itself, as well as renal stenosis. Bilateral renal stenosis will also affect blood flow to the kidneys.
Yeah, that's great. So it's basically just about low blood, anything that, again, you said, affecting blood flow. So it could be low blood volume or low blood perfusion of the kidneys. Now, that's pre-renal. So when we go to renal, that's what we call intrinsic causes of AKI. So that just means anything that causes direct damage to the kidneys or anything that involves direct damage. So one would be glomerulonephritis. So that's basically damage to the glomerulus, which is a filtration system that filters the incoming blood from the systemic circulation and filters it through into the kidneys, which then basically starts the process of filtration. The other cause would be tubular acute tubular necrosis, which can be divided into ischemic and toxic. So ischemic tubular necrosis is due to pre-renal causes. So when there's reduced perfusion to the kidneys, either due to low systemic blood volume or low blood flow to the kidneys themselves, it can actually lead to ischemia of the actual organ. So it can lead to end organ damage of the kidneys, and that can lead to tubular necrosis. Toxic acute tubular necrosis is when there's some sort of exogenous or endogenous toxin that damages the kidneys or the actual tubules in the kidneys. So you've got the proximal tubule, the distal tubules, the actual ascending and descending limb or the loop of Henle. So common drugs that can cause some sort of damage to the kidneys include antibiotics like gentamicin, NSAIDs, and proton pump inhibitors. So that's your acute tubular necrosis, again, which can be divided into ischemic and toxic. And the other cause of intrinsic or renal AKI is acute interstitial nephritis. And this is actually really interesting. I learned this during my clinical placement in the renal ward. There's actually a tetrad. There's actually certain features associated with interstitial nephritis, and that includes fever, rash, eosinophilia, and preserved urine output. So as I mentioned earlier, that the definition of AKI is usually, or the most common symptom if there is, would be reduced or no urine output. But interstitial nephritis is the one exception where there is preserved urine output. There's no change in urine output. But if you look at their blood results, they'll have high eosinophils. With their vitals, they'll have a fever, and they also might present with a rash. So when you're actually examining them, you will see a rash. Other causes of direct damage to the kidney could be like rhabdomyolysis, which is basically breakdown of muscle. So I know it's a lot to take in, but if I were to just then just summarize that, it would be, if we just talk about the different causes of intrinsic AKI, it would be glomerulonephritis, tubular necrosis, of which there's ischemic and toxic, acute interstitial nephritis, and rhabdomyolysis.
No, I was just going to say, it's kind of unfortunate, isn't it, that pre-renal is the most common cause of AKI, but pre-renal leads to intrinsic renal.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the most common ways. And how you were saying, like, if it's not diagnosed in time, it's very time critical, especially with pre-renal. If it's not diagnosed in time, some of the damage can be irreversible and can lead to persisting problems and complications, which we'll discuss in a bit. Yeah. So a last kind of classification for AKI would be your post-renal causes of AKI. And that's basically anything that blocks the drainage of urine that's been formed by the kidneys. So poor flow of the urine from the kidneys anywhere along the urinary tract. So you've got your kidneys, which then drain urine into the ureters, that then go into the bladder. And then once you actually go on to pass urine when you go to the toilet, it goes through the urethra and then out of your system. So anything that blocks that tract can lead to post-renal AKI because you've got that buildup of pressure that can lead to backflow and affect the actual function of the kidneys because of that high pressure. So certain causes of post-renal AKI would be kidney stones, which the terminology is nephrolithiasis. Any tumor, so it could be a tumor inside the actual tract or any extrinsic mass or tumor that's pressing on the ureters or the bladder and blocking the actual flow of urine. Benign prostatic hyperplasia, so this is in males where the prostate is very enlarged. And because the prostate wraps around the urethra, it can actually compress the urethra so it can block the flow of urine. And then any iatrogenic causes. So a lot of the times patients who've had catheters inserted for whatever reason, commonly let's say due to surgery, it can actually lead to certain damage in the actual walls leading to strictures and narrowing. And that narrowing can then, if it's really severe, can actually block the drainage of urine. So one thing to note is that basically how what you were saying, Xiao, pre-renal causes can lead to renal causes of AKI. If either pre-renal or post-renal disease persists long enough and it's not treated or addressed, it can lead to renal damage. And that's how post-renal causes AKI. is that it causes damage to the actual function of the kidneys, which leads to basically retention of toxins. The kidney is not able to do its function, and then they deteriorate.
That's such a good explanation. Thank you so much. Just a little story. Indulge me for a minute or two. I met a gentleman who presented to ED, and he actually had a catheter in for 18 months. And he came in, funny enough, not with an AKI, but he did come in with bladder retention, probably due to the fact that the catheter had been in there for such a long time. He was lost to follow-up, unfortunately. So he didn't present to hospital with the or be checked with the catheter in situ for a very, very long time. And I think he probably has had some strictures along that urinary path.
Yeah. That must be so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he just didn't know. He didn't know he had to take it out and like he needed to drain it, but he didn't know. I suppose he just wasn't sure that he didn't realize the importance about coming back to hospital and getting it checked and also getting it replaced as well.
Yeah. I think that's where like it's so important, regardless of where we are, like what condition we're talking about. Patient education is very, very important because patients are the center of your care and they're very much responsibility to take care of themselves, especially when they're not in hospital or not in direct contact with a doctor. So I think patient education is so, so important to prevent loss of follow-up.
That's right, I totally agree. And I guess COVID didn't really help anything, but another thing to note is we're living in a time, especially in metropolitan Melbourne, where you can access multiple health services at once. So he was treated by two different health services, and that's, I think, what really contributed to his loss of follow-up. Like he got the catheter inserted in one place, and it was being checked by the other people. And then the first place was very confused as to what was going on. And then the second people also was very confused about why it was even put in the first place. And then, 18 months later, he was like, oh, I don't know what I should do with the bag anymore. And then rocked up to a urinary clinic and they were like, oh, we should probably take it out. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if, the actual, like, if you were to have strictures, how severe they would be. Very interesting story. Yeah. Thank you, Shell, for sharing that.
No, that's all good. So, I mean, this gentleman, he was very lucky he didn't get an AKI, but for the other patients who do present with AKI, you were talking just now about the definition being something to do with investigations. So what investigations should we perform?
Yeah, so basically how I was mentioning, like usually the presentation can be very vague for AKI. There's not like one presentation that fits all when it comes to AKI. So investigations can give a lot of information about what's going on and even help to determine the cause of AKI. And also it's important to note that history and examination also themselves inform all the kinds of investigations you want to do. So I'm going to list down the main investigations and also some additional investigations you can do. Not all of these investigations are done in all patients. So the investigation is very much informed by history, examination, your differentials, and also vice versa. So to determine if there is an AKI, this is actually part of the definition. To have an AKI, you need to have a rise in serum creatinine and a drop in urine output or a drop in urine output. So either or, does not require both, but you need to have at least one, either a rise in serum creatinine or a drop in urine output.
Is there a specific amount that we should be trying to look for?
Yeah, so during my research, I've noticed that most sort of sites say that serum creatinine needs to rise by at least 1.5 times their baseline serum creatinine over a period of 7 days. Now, one caveat to that is that most patients who come in, let's say to ED, you may not even know what their baseline serum creatinine is. So it's very important to actually obviously measure their serum creatinine, but continuously measure it daily and see whether it's rising and how quickly it's rising. So if you find that it's rising very, very quickly over the next couple of days, then it again hints to, okay, this is an AKI. In terms of urine output, they say any urine output of less than 0.5 milliliters per kilogram per hour is kind of like the standard number. That's obviously really difficult. When a person passes urine, they don't know how much they're passing. So a lot of it can just be based on most of the times, if you want to actually have a proper measurement of the urine output, you might actually need to place in a catheter and monitor how much they're excreting per hour. But that's the hard and fast rule in terms of like what this clear definition is.
Okay, so 1.5 for serum creatinine, so 1.5 times more than baseline, and for urine output, it's the 0.5 mils per kg per hour. What about, I know when we do UECs, we really rely on the eGFR. Is eGFR even relevant in AKIs?
No, actually. So this is also something that like I found really shocking. But actually in the acute period, we do not rely on eGFR because eGFR requires an individual to have stable kidney function and creatinine production for it to be reliable. In AKI, because the kidney function is rapidly changing, whether in a good way or a bad way, eGFR is not a reliable indicator of kidney function because the actual kidney function is not stable. So yeah, that's actually a really good point that you brought up. You don't look at eGFR. So two things you want to know is serum creatinine urine output. That's kind of what's going to tell you, okay, if your presentation's vague, then that'll tell you, okay, there might be an AKI. Now, along with that, you also want to do, everyone has routine bloods done, which can also provide more information. So like a full blood count, if the white cell count is raised, you can think infection. And how I mentioned before, if there's high eosinophils, you want to think, oh, is this interstitial nephritis, acute interstitial nephritis? And electrolytes. Electrolytes are very, very important because kidneys are very important for ensuring electrolyte balance in the body.
Electrolytes specifically, are we looking for?
So usually you can order like CMP, you can look at the potassium levels, the phosphate, the magnesium, the calcium levels, the sodium levels. And the reason why you're looking at these is because you can have, with acute kidney injury, if there is electrolyte imbalance, the electrolytes can either be high or low depending on which ones we're looking at. So you can have hyperkalemia, which is high potassium, hyponatremia, low sodium, metabolic acidosis, where they have high like acid in their blood, hypocalcemia, low calcium, and hyperphosphatemia, so high phosphates. And the reason this happens is because the kidneys function to either reabsorb or filter these or excrete these electrolytes. When the kidneys are not able to perform their function, it actually builds up. And depending on what the actual function of the kidney is, it leads to higher or low levels of these electrolytes. I'm happy to actually, this area of electrolyte balance is actually quite complicated. So I'm happy to actually discuss this in another podcast where we talk about the function of the kidneys in relation to electrolyte imbalances.
Yeah, sounds good. Are there any other investigations that we should complete apart from bloods?
Yep. So you can do an ECG looking for complications to see whether, like for instance, if there's hyperkalemia, they might have tall tinted T waves. If they've got pericarditis, they might have the classic global concave ST elevation, PRO depression. So always consider doing an ECG. And then you can do other tests to get more information on the specific cause of AKI. So how I mentioned serum creatinine urine output, that tells you whether or not the person has an AKI. Once you've established they have an AKI and you've looked at their electrolytes, their full blood count, you want to know, okay, what's the cause? And along with the history and the examination, there are certain investigations you can do. So you can order a renal ultrasound or a CT kidney, ureter, bladder to rule out post-renal causes of AKI. Sometimes what you can even do is you can even insert a catheter and see whether the insertion of a catheter relieves a stricture and then you see a drop in the actual creatinine in urine and a rise in urine output. But renal ultrasound can more so just rule out the post-renal causes. You can also consider doing ordering a urea creatinine ratio. So the actual ratio itself, it's very interesting. I'm not really sure how sensitive this is, but if it's pre-renal causes of AKI, then usually the urea to creatinine ratio is more than 100:1. So you have a lot, very high levels of urea in relation to creatinine. And this is a serum test, I believe. So as I mentioned before, with acute kidney injury, you have retention of toxins, and the most common one is urea. So it makes sense to think why with pre-renal you'd have very high urea, because you don't have the actual blood that's reaching the kidney to actually filter out the urea. If it's renal, if there's a renal AKI, like a renal cause or an intrinsic cause for the AKI, then it's usually less than 40 to 1, the ratio. I'm actually not sure why the reason is for this ratio to exist, but if you want to remember it, you can remember it. And then post-renal AKI, or if you just got normal kidney function, the urea creatinine ratio can range anywhere between 40 to 100 to 1, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like urea creatinine ratio, which is a serum test, is most useful in pre-renal and intrinsic causes of AKI, as opposed to post-renal or normal, because post-renal just gives you normal results.
Yeah, exactly. So the pre-renal will be more than 100 to 1. Renal will be less than 40 to 1. Yeah. Other things you can do is you can order an albumin creatinine ratio and protein creatinine ratio. So I always used to get confused. I actually asked one of the residents, like, why do we order both an albumin and a protein creatinine ratio? Because albumin itself is a protein, and protein creatinine ratio looks at all the protein itself. And the reason is because in a person who has glomerulonephritis, you can actually distinguish between glomerular damage and other causes of AKI by comparing the albumin to creatinine ratio and protein to creatinine ratio. So if someone's got glomerulonephritis, it particularly affects the albumin. So albumin is filtered with glomerulonephritis or glomerular damage. Because there's damage, a lot of the albumin can actually be filtered through into the kidneys. And once it's filtered, it can actually then be excreted out of the urine. So albumin creatinine ratio is a urine test. And so if albumin creatinine ratio is high, but protein creatinine ratio is not as high, then you're thinking, okay, this might actually be glomerulonephritis. So it's useful in distinguishing whether there's glomerular damage or not, or intrinsic kidney damage. If there's intrinsic kidney damage, then albumin creatinine ratio may not be as high, but protein creatinine ratio will be high. Because with intrinsic kidney damage, all the tubules themselves, when there's tubular damage, the proteins can kind of slough off and enter into the tubules and then be excreted. So your protein creatinine ratio rises, but then your albumin creatinine ratio would stay the same, would be normal. Does that make sense? So it's very interesting. I actually had no idea, but I hope that kind of makes sense.
When you're saying slough off or sloth off, it sounds as if the protein that you're actually finding in the protein creatinine ratio is the actual tubules itself.
Yeah, so it's like the proteins. Yeah, exactly. And that's how you can differentiate, one way you can distinguish between glomerular and intrinsic kidney damage.
Whoa. Okay, cool.
Other investigations you can do is urinalysis and microscopy. So you can actually look at the presence of any urine casts. Now, there is a huge, there are heaps of different types of casts that you can see that are associated with different types of causes of AKI. So we can do it a bit more interactive. So I'll just throw out examples and you can just tell me what that indicates. Yeah? All right. So urine cast, if you see Hyaline casts, what does that mean?
Pre-renal due to hypovolemia.
Yep. So that's Hyaline. Yeah. So Hyaline casts are due to pre-renal causes. So if you see that, you're thinking, okay, it's probably a pre-renal cause for AKI. If there's a granular or muddy brown tubular epithelial cells, what are you thinking?
So it sounds like the tubules are dying. So acute tubular necrosis.
Yeah. Good. What if there are dysmorphic red blood cell casts?
Then that's probably more glomerular nephritis.
Yep. And the reason they're dysmorphic is because glomerular nephritis damages there's actual damage to the vessel itself. It can lead to damage of the red blood cells as they're moving from the glomerulus and into the kidneys. So they look very dysmorphic. White blood cell casts.
So this one indicates that white blood cells have somehow managed to enter into the genitourinary tract, so things like pyelonephritis, interstitial nephritis, glomerulonephritis as well, and transplant rejection.
Yeah. Yeah, because if a person's having a transplant rejection, they might have some sort of infection that's kind of leading to that, or some immune response. So that's good. And then there's other things like fatty casts, which can be nephrotic syndrome, or waxy casts, which can be chronic kidney disease. But I think yeah, we've covered most of them. Good. So there are other kind of things you can order as well. Investigations. You can order urine sodium concentration. You can order urine osmolality, which looks at how concentrated the urine is. And if you suspect glomerulonephritis, you can also consider doing a kidney biopsy, because that's the one that confirms the diagnosis of glomerulonephritis. And you can also consider if you suspect glomerulonephritis, like given the casts, given the Ellman-Creatinine ratio, the presentation, you can also consider doing a glomerulonephritis screen, which screens for different subcategories of glomerulonephritis.
More to talk about in another episode, I see.
Yeah.
Anyways, moving on. How do we diagnose AKI?
So the diagnosis is basically bringing it all together. Your history, your examination, your investigations basically help to determine the likely diagnosis. Part of the diagnosis you also want to know is how severe the kidney damage is. So there's actually a criteria that's used. It's called a RIFLE criteria, RIFLE. And that basically assesses the severity of acute kidney injury. And how I mentioned earlier, a lot of the times AKI is very time critical. So if it's not diagnosed early, it can lead to damage that might be irreversible or very severe damage. So I think it'll be good for those who are listening to actually on their own time, look at what this criteria is and see how it's used to assess the severity.
After diagnoses, we often manage. Mm-hmm. Now, there are lots and lots of different causes, but could you give us sort of a general framework as to how we can go about managing acquired kidney injury?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not acquired, acute kidney injury.
Acute injury, okay, that's okay. So in general, like the general management for AKI is you want to consider reducing the dose or stopping any medications that you think may be contributing to kidney damage or affecting kidney function. Whether or not that's the original cause is another thing, but you don't want to cause any further or persistent damage. So at least in the acute phase, you want to stop or reduce the dose of any medication. So that could be your NSAIDs, antibiotics, any immunosuppressants like tacrolimus, contrast, so avoid giving contrast. You also want to monitor vitals, especially blood pressure, weight, especially the blood pressure, and it's along with vitals, monitoring their weight, their fluid intake, their urine output, and their serum creatinine, because that's also informing on how well the kidneys are functioning and whether there's any fluid overload or underload. And you want to treat and reverse the cause. So hopefully by the time you get to management, you've been able to identify what the cause is, and then there's targeted treatments for that cause, which I will not go into detail in this episode. And then you want to treat early. So with longer duration, when there's longer duration to treatment, there's more damage to the kidneys, and the higher chance that the damage may be irreversible and may progress to chronic kidney damage. So you also want to make sure that you treat as soon as possible, and also consider the need for dialysis. So there's this really good mnemonic that I've used to look at like what are indications for dialysis, and that's AEIOU. Do you know what they stand for, Shell?
Yes, I do have a cheat sheet, but yes, okay. I do. So A stands for acidosis. E stands for electrolyte imbalances, like hyperkalemia, and I'm guessing all the other electrolyte imbalances that you were talking about just now as well. I stands for ingestion of toxins. O stands for fluid overload, and this is in specifically fluid overload that doesn't respond anymore to diuretics. And then uremia as well.
Yeah, and then under uremia, like things can be like pericarditis, encephalopathy, those signs. Good. And then once you've kind of done those general measures, depending on what the cause is, like I can give some basic stuff. So if it's pre-renal cause of AKI and it's due to hypovolemia, give them fluid. So increase oral intake, maybe consider IV fluids. If they've got low volume that's causing the AKI. If they're hypervolemic, so they're fluid overloaded due to whatever reason, then give them diuretics, restrict their fluid, and restrict their salt intake. In terms of intrinsic, basic stuff, if it's due to glomerulonephritis, commonly it's managed with steroids or immunosuppressants. If it's acute tubular necrosis that's secondary to hypovolemia, give fluids. If it's contrast-induced AKI, then give fluids to wash out the contrast from the system. And then if it's post-renal cause, then remove the obstruction. So that could be either by inserting a catheter or inserting a stent. You can even consider a nephrostomy to bypass the obstruction if it's very severe and it's unable to be removed with a catheter or a stent. Now, that's kind of like basics of management. I'll just quickly cover complications. So as I mentioned before, with AKI, there can be irreversible damage. It can progress to chronic kidney disease. There can be electrolyte imbalances that can be very severe, especially with hyperkalemia. That's one of the most important ones. One of the very important ones, because it can actually affect the heart function. And if it's not treated, it can lead to cardiac arrest. So it's very important to make sure that electrolytes are balanced and they're monitored and they're addressed. And in most cases, the kidneys can recover from the acute insult and regain its baseline function. So it's not like an AKI is something that's going to kind of persist. It's an acute kidney injury. However, there are cases where it doesn't happen and the damage can be permanent. So it's just important to make sure that it's identified early, it's treated early, and there's no further harm done to the kidney. So avoid contrast, avoid giving additional medications that can damage the kidney, ensure there's proper fluid balance, and make sure to check baseline kidney function before considering contrast-based imaging studies. So all these things can be done to prevent any irreversible damage.
All right. Thank you so much, Simran, for teaching us all about AKI. That was a lot of information, but a lot of good information. If you like what you listen to, please give us a like on our Facebook page. You can find us on Mini Med Pods, MiniMedPods on Facebook. You can also email us on our Gmail at minimedpods@gmail.com if you have any comments or suggestions on what to do next, or perhaps you'd like to tell us what you thought about it. You can also email your questions and give us a little bit of support by telling us what you think. And we'd love to hear from all you guys. So Simran, would you like to tell us the resources that our listeners could perhaps look up to find out more information?
Yep. So resources that I've kind of used to get some information about this and you guys can also look at is AMBOSS is a really good website. Life in the Fast Lane, I learned a lot about electrolyte imbalances and kidney function tests, from that website. And then a lot of the resources that I've used or knowledge that I've gained is through clinical placement and observation. So if you are a medical student and you're on placement, make the most of it, ask questions. Rely on your peers to learn from them as well. So you can always use them as a resource too.
That's right. And you can also learn from fellow students, just as I have done today. So this is bye from us. Thank you very much for listening to us once again. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.